Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Derek Corneille, renowned and esteemed computer science professor emeritus, University of Toronto. Derek, you have a considerable history of notable distinction and significant outstanding contributions as a founder, scientist, researcher, and innovator. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
And thank you for the invitation, Stephen.
Now, Derek, can you describe your journey into computing from your youth up to the present? What foundational lessons you learned from this journey and why you were initially attracted to computing?
Well, I guess, as with most of us, our life journey is very much a series of accidents, and mine was no exception. At the time I was an undergraduate student, there was very little interest in computing other than the announcement, in my case, that there was a big computer that had been purchased by the London Life Insurance Company in London, Ontario. That's where I grew up, and my dad worked for the company. And very fortunate, I guess it was my second year, maybe it was my first year undergrad. First summer, I got a job operating the UNIVAC Mark II they had there. This was a magnetic tape machine, and one of the jobs I had was to operate a printer, which, of course, by today's standards sounds rather crazy. But in fact, it was a non-trivial job and had to be careful regarding the buildup of electric charge, etc. Then through a beautiful series of accidental happenstance, I guess, I happened to be in the office of a guy at London Life when a fellow from Labatt's in London phoned. And I had a scholarship with Labatt and was wondering about getting a job programming. I knew they were getting a computer, an IBM 1401, and wondered if I could get a job with them. Since I had been promised a job programming for London Life, but that was withdrawn since I had a scholarship through Labatt that required that I give my teaching contract to the London Board of Education. Anyway, I happened to be in this office when the call came through, and somehow the fellow at Labatt's got the idea that I knew how to program the UNIVAC machine. So when I arrived at Labatt's for the summer job programming, the fellow there said, well, since you already know how to program the UNIVAC, we've given you 2 weeks to learn how to program the IBM 1401. Of course, I replied that I did not know how to program, and the guy looked at me and said, well, what are we going to do? My response was, well, I guess I've got 2 weeks to teach myself how to program. And, you know, many nights, actually about 3 or 4 days, I finally started to understand what was going on. And this was, there were no self-help programming for dummies type of manuscripts at that point, but I did have the manual, the instruction manual, and eventually figured out what was going on. And that's how I became a programmer. Then at the end of my undergraduate at Queen's, there was, and I should point out that I had a couple of really good summer jobs with Labatt's where they gave me some interesting computing projects to work on and to head up, actually. So then looking at graduate school and wanting to sort of do some more work, more education before going on to high school teaching in London, and heard that Toronto had a new master's program starting. So I applied to that, and of course that's where things really took off. Did my master's and then stayed on for my PhD. That's when I got involved with Kelly Gottlieb, a name that will come up many times during this discussion. And that was the start of my enjoyment of computing and doing research. The lessons I learned, I guess, always be prepared for a surprise. And of course, doing research, that's one of the most exciting aspects of it, that you never know from one day to the next the opportunity that's going to present itself and the new direction your work will go. Also, from the point of view, and this is with my own children who are interested in computing, and the advice I gave them, first advice was make sure you're good in mathematics. Second piece of advice is make sure you're good in English. If you can't express yourself properly in your own natural language, how can you expect to be able to express yourself or a solution to a problem in a artificial computer language? Anyway, it was a great journey and a lot of fun, especially for someone who was told going out of high school that I was making a terrible mistake planning to do a honors math and physics degree, and that the best I could hope for was to go to a technical college or possibly a general BA. And as the fellow said, if you think that you can make a livelihood out of being a mathematician, you've got another thought coming. And I should point out that he was the English teacher, but that was his advice, not to go to university.
Well, that's interesting. In those early days, then, when you were sort of as an undergrad, and you were programming sort of on the side, was the languages like assembler or?
Sometime, when we started with the 1401, it was a machine language initially, and then we got into SAS, an assembler language. But initially, it was machine language itself.
I see, and you inputted this using switches, or did you input this using punch cards?
At this point, it was punch cards, yeah. The UNIVAC machine that I operated, that was magnetic tape.
I see. So programming in machine language is pretty difficult.
Yes, that's my memory of it. A lot of emphasis was put on flow charting at the time. And little did I know that this was my first contact with graph theory, vertices or points and edges. And remember, I came up with a 68-page flow chart for the job I was doing, the first job Labatt gave me. And Labatt was very concerned with privacy issues, so we had to lock all our work up overnight to make sure there'd be no industrial espionage. But I've always thought that the best thing that could have happened regarding Labatt versus its competition is if they had somehow leaked these flowcharts to competitive companies. They would never have understood what I was doing. Very early days, and nothing had been taught regarding the methodology of programming. I came to that quite a bit later when I spent considerable time working with Edsger Dijkstra. Got involved with structured programming and top-down refinement and things like that, which influenced a lot the way I not only programmed, but the way I taught programming and problem-solving and development of algorithms.
Well, that's really fascinating. So, you know, on this next question, I talk about before 1964, describe the educational landscape for those interested in computing. I guess there wasn't much.
I think you just answered the question. Absolutely nothing. There were no undergraduate courses. I was not until later aware that there were any computers at Queen's University. And then I heard later that there was a small one in the civil engineering department. But, of course, no undergraduate students involved.
And I guess that leads to my next question. While an undergraduate at Queen's, what computers and computing courses were available? I guess it's very little.
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing.
And I can understand now why the University of Toronto was so attractive.
Well, it was, and especially for someone who, through my summer jobs at Labatt, had gotten into some interesting questions and interesting projects to work on. And I could really understand research, and I was supervised there by a PhD in chemistry, a fellow who had been at Western and then transferred to Labatt because he had more time for his own private research at Labatt. So it was great having him as my supervisor, and it really was my start in involvement with academic type of supervision.
Well, you know, you talked about your undergraduate years at Queen's, and you finally enter into the University of Toronto because they do have programs and courses in computer science. So, and we'll call that the Department of Computer Science, or DCS, for the remainder of the interview. So can you profile your professors in those early years of the DCS?
Yeah, of course, there were no computer scientists. There were a couple of physics profs, Kelly Gottlieb, of course, being one of them. A couple of math profs, in other words, people who got their PhDs in mathematics, a couple from electrical engineering, and if I remember correctly, one from psychology. There was also a fellow who had been brought in from industry without a PhD, but that was pretty well the sort of the academic profile of the faculty at the time.
That reminds me, I did an interview with Chuck Thacker, and he talked about one particular fellow when he was designing the first modern PC, and he had a background, I believe, in psychology, and it made a substantial difference in their design decisions.
So. I was going to say, the psychologist, I think his interest was not so much in what we now call HCI, but rather just general interest in computing. I don't remember any work in that in those days talking about the actual interface between computers and humans.
Now, can you describe those early years in 1964 as one of the seven initial graduate students of the graduate program in DCS at the University of Toronto?
Certainly, and first of all, to get into the program, and this was in the initial year of the graduate program, there were students who were enrolled in other departments that were doing computer science type research, but actually initial applicants and admissions to the computer science department, that was the seven of us. And at that point, it was preferable but not required that you know how to program. And in fact, I think there were three of us who did know how to program before we entered. The other three or four did not know. A lot of time, I remember a lot of discussions that we had amongst ourselves as to whether or not we were making a terrible career mistake. In those days, it was not clear, and it seems strange to think of that situation now looking back, but it was not clear that computer science really was an academic discipline in its own right. And the counter-argument would be, well, we don't have a calculator science department, we don't have a slide rule department, so why would we have a computer science department? And a lot of us, and we came in from various backgrounds, such as math in my case, or electrical engineering and other areas for the other students, wondering whether or not we had made a mistake. And again, some of the top universities in the world at that point had said no, they were not going to follow the route of having a computer science department.
It must be pretty amazing for you then when you consider where computing has gone, and you know, I think global output is about $80 trillion right now, and without computers it would be nothing virtually. So,
well, again, we were sort of in the dark. Something was happening, but we had no idea what was going on. For example, at about that time, there was a Blue Ribbon Committee in the UK that was charged with determining the computing needs in the entire UK up to and including the year 2000. And their report was that six Atlas machines, Atlas, you know, again, a small machine, would be enough to meet all that demand up till and including the year 2000. Very, very few people saw what was going to happen. And that's, again, one of the key roles that Kelly Gottlieb plays.
Yeah, Kelly's quite a visionary and seeing and realizing the potential from those even very early days.
Absolutely. And again, being, he was, as you know, he was my supervisor of my PhD thesis. And he talked quite openly in seminars and in his own course about areas that he thought were important and what he envisaged. And to a lot of it, we just rolled our eyes and, you know, thought, you must be kidding. But that's the genius of Kelly. He saw this.
Well, you just mentioned that Kelly was your supervisor. And so can you describe in the process of obtaining your PhD and how this has changed?
Well, first of all, how did I get connected with Kelly? There was a course that Kelly taught, G17. I'm not sure. I think the G stood for general, but I'm more inclined to believe it stood for Gottlieb, because it was really his views of computer science and what was going to be important. He talked about his early work in data structures, talked about graph theory, and that's where I got hooked. I really fell in love with the graph theory and asked him to supervise my PhD. In many ways, now returning to your question itself, not much has changed. It's still sort of an apprenticeship, one of the few apprenticeship types of relationships we have in modern society, where you're working closely with an expert and you slowly somehow end up with a thesis. We certainly have a lot more in the way of checkpoints and protections for students and a committee structure that helps the students, but that was there as well then. So the actual relationship between student and the supervisor is such an individual and personal relationship that that really hasn't changed. So there was a lot of extra help we have now with the checkpoints, you know, research proposals, thesis proposals, committee structure that help the student, and again, to identify if a student's having problems earlier and therefore be able to help him or her earlier. But for the most part, it's pretty well the same way as it's gone for the last, two or three centuries.
So in those early days, though, because you're really at the birth of computing, And from an educational standpoint, and as a science, you must have really developed a close relationship with Kelly. Spent a lot of time with him in many respects.
Well, yes, I mean, it was Kelly's style was that we would meet once a week or once every 2 weeks, with the clear understanding that if I didn't have something to present, then don't waste his time. You just sort of postpone the meeting. And so we had regular meetings, and I spent a lot of time with him. But the time I spent with him on the supervision was very much on just the academic work. It was only through social areas that I got to know Kelly much better as a person, and our very strong friendship developed. But he was in charge of the department in the early days, as well as the institute and all the work he was doing. He was extremely busy, and the time I had with him was dedicated to my research.
Now, what are some of the notable events at the University of Toronto in those early years of the DCS?
Well, certainly a couple of things. One was Pat Hume, so this is now very early days, and a electronic transmission of to the University of Saskatchewan, and early developments of programming languages, compilers, and the work that Pat Hume did in these areas. Certainly Kelly's early work in data structures, a lot of work in numerical analysis. Val Volcan, who supervised my master's thesis and later went to Berkeley, is a Turing Award winner for establishing a lot of the numerical protocols and handling round-off error and floating-point arithmetic and setting up those protocols. So there was a lot of work of this type coming out of DCS early on.
I know that at the lecture that Kelly did in March, there was a sort of mention that the computer science faculty at the University of Toronto is sort of ranked in the top 8 in the world, and I thought that was quite remarkable.
Yeah, and there's a number of rankings of the department. There's certainly 1-8, and there's a couple of recent ones, world rankings, where we placed 10th in both of the rankings. And in the one case, we're the first non-U.S. university, and always by far the first amongst the Canadian universities. So there's tremendous international reputation the department has.
It's interesting, though, from a public relations standpoint, many Canadians may not be aware of the pioneering leadership of DCS at the University of Toronto.
I think that's absolutely right. And yet, I guess one of the main measures of our leadership is if you look at the faculty of other Canadian computer science departments and look at the number of faculty who received their PhD from U of T and DCS, I think we're not only are we number one, but last I looked, it was much higher than number 2, 3, and 4 put together. So we've had a tremendous dominating effect in steering the computer science development throughout the universities in Canada. But again, you're right. We have not done a great job of advertising.
You know, as one of the 7 initial graduate students of the graduate program in the Department of Computer Science, or DCS, at the University of Toronto, you'd have a pretty good perspective of the challenges that DCS had to overcome over the years and the opportunities that DCS enabled.
Yeah, and we had a lot of problems. Well, of course, just developing a new department in any university is always very difficult because you've really got to get resources from that are already existing, and other departments are going to pay for the birth and development of a new department. In this regard, Tom Hull, who succeeded Kelly as the chair of computer science, arranged for us to become a undergraduate department in 1972. Before that, we did all our arts and science teaching in under the auspices of the math department. So Tom did a lot of work and an excellent job in building up the of the faculty in the late 60s to the mid 70s. And again, at times where other major universities were saying they did not want to get involved in computer science, Tom did a tremendous job of recruiting a lot of young people and building a department. It was especially difficult. One of the major challenges that he faced was the fact that our faculty, on average, was so young, many of us had no experience administratively, and now all of a sudden we've got to develop curriculum, we've got to develop our guidelines for our graduate program, we've got to do admissions. So this was very, very trying times just to keep things going and to get it started. And again, Tom Hull deserved a tremendous amount of credit for that.
And it kind of reminds me of, there's, you know, a company called Fairchild, and they sort of spawned a number of other companies called Fairchildren many, many years ago. So I sort of get sort of feeling of University of Toronto and all of your graduate and PhD students who have finished going off and sort of flowering the world, you know, in terms of setting up departments or inspiring in innovations or going to all different regions. Can you share any stories about that at all? Or?
Well, so much of it is anecdotal, but you're absolutely right, and we've done a lot of education, international education. We've had, amongst our PhDs, we've had a number of, and I'm going back again, early days, number of Indian students, couple Brazilians, an Egyptian student. So a lot of students who then went back to their own countries and were involved in sort of building the computing science academic infrastructure inside their country, as well as a lot of people going into industry, and of course a lot in Canada. A lot of places, the initial courses that they put up were modeled after the University of Toronto courses. And then, of course, there would be changes later as they got more input and a broader-based faculty. But there's certainly, in all the curriculum that you would see in Canadian universities and a lot of other universities, you'll see the vestiges of the early DCS days.
And then even the textbooks that were authored by faculty at U of T being used worldwide.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And Rick Holt developed the Turing programming language at the University of Toronto, and that became a broad-based programming language, both in universities, lower level, but also a little bit in the higher level, but also in high schools. A lot of things like that that had quite an impact.
Just simply amazing. Now, earlier we talked about this sort of relationship you had with Kelly and continue to have with Kelly Gottlieb. So from your insider perspective, can you describe in more detail your time with Kelly Gottlieb and from those early years up to the present?
Yeah, certainly it was Kelly's vision of graph theory, my academic passion, as being an important mathematics underlying computer science. And Kelly, in fact, went around and sat in on a bunch of math courses, including a graph theory course taught by Bill Tutte. And at that point, he realized the importance of graph theory and graph algorithms in the growth of computing. And so that's what first attracted me to Kelly. One of the biggest influences Kelly had on me, apart from research, was as I was close to completing my PhD, I really wondered what career options I would have. And, of course, I was enjoying the research and was interested in possibility of becoming an academic. And, but I was worried just the amount of time, and I saw how busy Kelly was and the other faculty members and whether or not there was room and time for a family life. And, through Kelly and Phyllis and their family and social encounters with them, I, certainly saw how outside the department, his priority was his family. And I remember one time, Barb and I, my wife and I were at the Gottliebs, and we arrived, and Kelly, immediately shushed us and said, okay, just have to stand here and wait, I'm busy. And he got down on his hands and knees and was playing hide and go seek with his, giggling 4-year-old daughter. And I really believe at that point that Barb and I decided that, yes, it is possible to have an academic career and a family, and a fulfilling family life. And that's really when I decided I wanted to be an academic. So there, you know, I can talk about all the things that he inspired academically, but in many ways the most important thing he inspired in me was the possibility that you could have a very well-balanced life.
That's just so interesting. What additional stories can you share of Kelly Gottlieb as the father of computing?
Well, I can remember certainly one time that Kelly gave a talk, and again, it was seminar on here's my vision of computer science and what's going to happen. And he mentioned, and I guess this would have been about 1967, where he said he envisaged the day when we could send a message electronically, instantaneously around the world for free, but it would cost us 50 cents to send a postcard to our kid at camp. And that just blew everybody's mind on both counts. Not only this idea of an electronic free message instantaneous, we just couldn't understand. Well, that was amazing. But also, I don't think any of us ever believed that stamps would ever cost 50 cents. So there was certainly that type of thing that Kelly did. And also his, well, again, this is a personal, getting back to personal things, so getting away from the sort of innovative computer science. At one point, Kelly and I had one terrible fight, and it was both some stupid thing. The use of the past subjunctive in modern technical writing. I insisted that I was going to use past subjunctive if this were the case rather than if this was the case. Kelly pulled out heavy guns, namely referring to Phyllis's writing and saying, nope, that's archaic, you don't use that at all. And it turned out that night we were going to the Gottliebs for dinner, and I went home to Barb and said, gee, I just don't know if we can. Kelly and I just, we were both in a foul mood and had a lousy night. I don't think I'm going to be able to go. And, of course, she said, yes, you are going to go. don't be such an idiot. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, Kelly's first comment to me as soon as I arrived at the door. And it was, and of course, I was quite apprehensive of what he was going to say. And his first question was, hi, Derek, do you want a beer? So I learned a lot that academic arguments have absolutely nothing to do with personal interaction.
I was fortunate to attend a 90th birthday lecture at the University of Toronto in March, and then the dinner reception that followed. And you recounted this story about IFIP, and I thought that was interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, this was in 1968, I believe. I attended the IFIP Congress in Edinburgh, and there was an excursion bus, and I was sitting on the bus, and other people were there, and Kelly either got on the bus or walked outside. And people were looking at him and pointing, oh, there's Kelly Gottlieb. You know, yes, that's Kelly. And it was clear that he had an incredible international following. And as I quipped at the at his gala, that at that point he was Canadian academia's answer to Justin Bieber. But it was also just being Kelly's student opened tremendous doors for me. For example, in the summer of 71, I did a lecture tour of the UK, and I would write to people and just say, you know, I'm planning to be there. I was wondering if I could come and meet you and give a lecture. And, oh, by the way, I am Kelly Gottlieb's student. Well, the doors swung wide open. And again, when I went there and met people, and it was, oh yes, telling me how they got to know Kelly and things like that, and their comments about him as a visionary and as a person. I really realized how lucky I had been having him as my supervisor.
And I was thinking of the note sent by Fran Allen, who was the first woman to receive the Turing Award, and her recognition of Kelly's sort of leadership and vision and all of that. I just thought his work continues, right?
And again, along a very similar line, his encouragement of women to be involved, you know, the fact that it's absolutely ludicrous that we don't have a lot more female faculty, female award winners, etc. And instead of just moaning and groaning about it, he actually did a lot, as Jim Horney and Fran Allen also pointed out at the gala, that he was absolutely insisting that there had to be strong representation and recognition of the tremendous accomplishments women have already made in computer science.
Now, we know that Kelly is an inspiration to you, but are there others?
Yes, there were a number. Certainly my postdoc supervisors, Yap Seidel, who a mathematician in Eindhoven, had a lot of impact. He was very much a mentor to me mathematically, as well as a very close friend, and not only just he and I, but also our families. Edgar Dijkstra, who I also spent time with on my postdoc, certainly had a lot of influence on my view of the methodology of problem solving, of algorithm development, of programming, and he was quite a visionary in that area, and I really enjoyed a lot of discussions with Edgar in this area. I was also influenced a lot by Bill Tutt. That was the first graph theory book I had read, and although it wasn't algorithmic, or at least not much in the way of algorithms, very clearly written, and he was a true pioneer, and he was the one who established the combinatorics and optimization department at the University of Waterloo, and a tremendous intellect. I didn't know him well. I met him a few times, but I was greatly influenced by his work and his research and his writing.
Now, from your own perspective, how would you describe one of DCS's innovative achievements? And you can choose the one that sort of really resonated with you. And this is in terms of what specifically inspired the innovation, what were the factors that made the innovation possible, the problem solved, and the impact it has today and even into the future.
I guess for that I would, and again I'll stay close to my own area, namely theoretical computer science, and here I would turn to Steve Cook and the work he did on complexity. Some of this work had started while he was still at Berkeley before he came to the University of Toronto, but of course a lot of the work was done at U of T in the continuation. Steve's still on faculty here. And there it was sort of understanding how to measure the complexity of an algorithm. In the mid-60s, a lot of our concern when we looked at algorithms was space. Did we have enough memory? And we didn't really worry too much about time because, after all, we could just let the computer run overnight and get our answer the next morning. And, of course, this indicates that the problems we were solving were very small. But our biggest worry was trying to shoehorn everything into the limited amount of memory that we had. Steve pioneered the understanding of complexity of algorithms. So, yes, we do worry about the amount of space a problem requires, but more importantly, at least from the early work that Steve did, is the understanding of the amount of time that the algorithm would require or the problem itself could ever expect to get. So it was not just of particular algorithms, but does there exist an algorithm for such and such a problem that can work in a certain amount of time? And again, asymptotic bounds on the running time. And Steve developing the notion of polynomial time on a deterministic Turing machine versus polynomial time on a non-deterministic Turing machine. And the famous question, does P equal NP? Are these two times the same? And that is still one of the millennium problems, one of the major open mathematical questions. And it's not just a theoretical question, but it also has enormous practical significance. As soon as we show that a problem is NP-hard or NP-complete and therefore is intractable and therefore saying we have no reason to expect at this point that there could be a polynomial time algorithm to solve this problem, particularly you're forced to have exponential time, again, subject to the P equal NP question being solved, it means that in practice, even with modern computers, you typically cannot solve more than problem of size 17 or 18, maybe up to 20. That's how bad the exponential growth is. And so this has required a lot of development of heuristic algorithms. And again, not only from a theoretical perspective, but also from a practical perspective. How do we deal with the traveling salesperson problem in practice? It's a problem we encounter all the time. Well, companies have been developed to look at this problem. And a lot of heuristics are developed. And it's fascinating for me to see that the techniques that were developed and are still being developed to deal with NP-hard problems and NP-complete problems are also starting to occur when we talk about polynomial time problems. For example, suppose you just want to calculate a distance matrix in a graph. You want to find the shortest distance between any two vertices. Our current algorithms require close to order n cubed time, so the amount of work grows as the cube of the number of vertices. Well, if you look at the size of graphs that we look at, 10 million nodes and then try to run an n-cubed algorithm. You might as well be dealing with an exponential algorithm. You just can't wait that long. And so we're seeing the same type of techniques that were developed for NP-complete problems, namely heuristics, now starting to apply to our very large input for polynomial time problems. So it's no longer the case that polynomial is good, exponential, or NP-complete is bad. There's a lot of bad things that happen with polynomial time algorithms, and also some very good things that happen with NP-complete problems. For example, the cutting stock problem or the bin packing problem, where let's say you've got a set of I-beams and you have to meet customers' orders, and what's the best way to arrange these cuttings so that you minimize the total number of beams you require? Well, that problem is NP-complete or NP-hard, the way I've stated it. But a very simple greedy algorithm of called first-fit decreasing guarantees to be within 11/9 of optimal and requires just the time to do a sort, let's say n log n. So in some cases, there are some NP-complete problems I'd rather have to deal with in practice than some of our old standard polynomial time problems that require n cubed or worse time, that seem to require this. So Steve's work just permeates all of computer science. Anything that involves an algorithm and the analysis of an algorithm and the complexity, both from a practical and theoretical perspective, this all grew out of Steve's work.
Yeah, that's really quite fascinating. In fact, Steve was at the lecture and dinner reception.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And he has a Turing Award as well.
Yep.
And I should mention for the audience is that the Turing Award is sort of considered the Nobel equivalent, but in computing. Now, Derek, can you share some stories about the DCS, perhaps something amazing, surprising, amusing? You already have, but are there additional stories you can share?
Again, staying with the Steve Cook story, and as I mentioned, he had been at Berkeley, and Tom Hull was the chair at the time, and was trying to woo Steve and Linda, his wife, to come to Toronto. At that point, the department occupied the 11th and 12th floors of the Burton Tower, Physics Tower. And Tom knew that Steve was a very avid sailor. And so every morning, Tom would phone Steve and sit in his office overlooking the bay, counting the number of sailboats. And so Tom would count and tell Steve the number of sailboats out in the bay. And then he would pause and say, no, I missed a couple behind that pillar there. Yes, there's three more. And as Steve said after he arrived, that there was just no way he could have said no to Tom. So it was That was certainly one of the greatest coups our department achieved in attracting Steve here, and Tom did that. There was also a lot of early days where we had, and Tom put a lot of emphasis on developing the camaraderie and the friendship in the department, and we had some wonderful Christmas parties with skits, and these were designed by a fellow named John Mason, who later returned to England. He was a faculty member. And wrote material for Beyond the Fringe in the UK. So a lot of really great skits. And when John left, the rest of us had to take over, so the caliber deteriorated. There were also a lot of sort of a general, it's not quite a story, but more situation in the department that throughout the life of the department, there has been very, very little politics inside the department. The department has run very smoothly. Everybody sort of has the attitude that, okay, I'll do what I can to help, but main thing is give us time, make us able to find time to get back to our research, our graduate student supervision, our teaching, etc. So very few people sort of were weak researchers or weak teachers and therefore tried to develop a career by making the administration so onerous to other people. And unfortunately, you see that quite a bit in academia at times. And we were very fortunate that we've had none of that. And again, I think this is reflective of the commitment my colleagues have to both their research as well as their teaching.
Well, that's quite fascinating. And I could sort of sense that atmosphere at the dinner reception where, you know, there were a number of faculty there from the Department of Computer Science, and you could see that sort of collaboration and sharing and camaraderie. I was also impressed with your job as MC, so Master of Ceremonies at the dinner reception, and I can see why you had that role, because you're so pivotal in DCS and the University of Toronto, but you're also so pivotal with Kelly as well in terms of your very long relationship association, and also as being one of the first graduate students. So can you maybe share some experiences from that lecture and from the dinner reception? And this is with regards to Kelly's 90th birthday lecture and 90th birthday dinner reception held at the University of Toronto in March of this year.
Yeah, certainly it was an honor and a great pleasure for me to be the MC, to be asked to be the MC. We had, as a department, had put Kelly forward for one of the Globe and Mail Transformative Canadians Award. And that started before this. And I helped the department, since I was the one who knew the most about Kelly, or certainly I knew a lot about his early days, and was involved in putting together the application. And in so doing, came across a lot of things that I had either forgotten or had never known, and was just blown away by it. And at that point, the application we put forward, and unfortunately Kelly was not successful in getting that for reasons I cannot understand, but it took a life of its own as the staff and the faculty who were putting this together realized what an incredible resource we have in Kelly and how many stories that just have to be recorded. And again, great deal of credit to you for the interviews you've done with Kelly. That was one of our big sources of information. But just realizing what an incredible asset he is, and an incredible friend, and an incredible person. And a little small personal story afterwards, I went up to him and I said, "Kelly, I can never thank you enough for all you've done for me." And he looked at me in his shy way and said, "Well, I think you've taken a big step tonight." So it was a magical evening. A lot of the great stories, including the ones that you told, it was just so wonderful to get all this and have his family there and his friends there. And hopefully it makes us all realize what a impact he has had on our lives, and lesser importance on the field of computing itself. The guy is just amazing.
Yeah, an incredible history of accomplishment and innovation and encouragement and mentorship, you name it, and just crossing so many domains. So.
Yes. Also, another story that I've never told, and this is a story that happened after I was back on faculty. A former secretary came in to see me, and she had her baby with her, and I was just talking with her, and she had said that the reason she had to leave was because she was pregnant. And in those days, that was a major problem, to be an unwed mother. And she said that she talked to Kelly. He was the chair of the department at the time. And she said, "He will never know how appreciative I am of the way he treated me." And he celebrated the fact that I was going to have a baby rather than damned me the way other people did. And he said, "Look, the only thing that's important here is your role as a mother of this baby." And she said, "It meant so much to me." And again, this is the type of thing with Kelly. There's certainly all the high profile things that we know he's done, but there was this personal interaction and how much he influenced and impacted the life of this woman.
Yeah, it speaks to Kelly's humanity.
Exactly. Absolutely.
At the reception or at the lecture, did you have any chance to talk to Mike Williams at all?
No, I did not.
And just for the audience, like Mike has done a series of recordings with Kelly spanning, I guess, close to 20 years now. And the transcripts from those would be something like over 70 pages, but he just did one following the event that happened in March. So it'll probably be about 100 pages once it's all completed. So I'd encourage the audience to, or the listeners to, through the IEEE CS or the ACM, have a look at the transcripts. It's just amazing history captured.
As well as, I would add, your interviews of Kelly, your source that we used in putting together our application for.
Now, Derek, can you profile the current work and standing of the DCS? And we've covered some of this already, but maybe you can get into more detail.
Yeah, certainly I've talked about the ratings, international ratings of our department. There's a couple of other things that the department's done, and certainly we're not the only department to have done this, but I think we made a really good move, I guess, at the start of about 10, 12 years ago, and that was to develop the role of teaching faculty. And so these are colleagues who have at least a master's, some of them have a PhD in computer science, and they are in charge of a lot of the undergraduate teaching roles. So they do the development of curriculum, the coordination of some of our multi-section courses. Of course, the research faculty also teach, but they've, first of all, they're without exception phenomenal teachers, and a lot of our undergraduate students, especially our low-level undergraduate students who are shopping and then get turned on by computer science, it's because of the work done by these men and women. And it also means that the research faculty do not have the jobs of, say, coordinating multi-section courses, arranging, or doing all the administrative work behind a multi-section course, you know, things like that, and handling cheating cases, some of the onerous tasks of teaching these people handle, and just do a fantastic job, and I think really enrich the environment for our undergraduate students. The other thing we've done quite a bit of is professional experience here. Everybody usually talks about co-op and the importance of co-op. Professional experience here was developed in the Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering at U of T, and we were the first department outside engineering to be involved with it. In this program, instead of having a four-month co-op placement, the students, either at the end of the second or their third year, have a full one-year placement in industry, which means that they get a very good project. A four-month project, by the time you get somebody trained to work on the project and then solve it and then sort of pass on the solution, it's awfully difficult to do, whereas a year project, or 12 to 16 months, they can also work during the summer, where they're paid by the company. Average salary, I think, is around $44,000. These students then get a really good exposure to interesting problems in business and industry. The agreement is, of course, that they must complete their degree, but a lot of them, after completing their degree, then go back to the company. And a lot of companies have expressed their interest in a PEY type of placement as opposed to the traditional co-op. Another area where recent innovation, we're in the process of developing a professional master's program. And this is, and we're taking it slowly. We have hundreds of applications for this, but we're growing the program very slowly. We've only admitted six the first year, and I think about the same the second year. These students take courses designed for them. They are not involved in the development of a research project itself from the point of view of doing the research, but rather in helping to transport the problem and the solution into industry. So they'd have their internship with industry, with part of the supervision coming from a faculty member who has some ideas that he or she thinks would impact industry. And so the match is made, and so the student is involved in understanding the problem, and of course we get involved in the problem and help with further solution, but in transforming these solutions to what could be used by the industrial contact. So again, that's a new area that we're very slowly bringing up before. We want to make sure we've got the proof of concept before we try to make it a lot larger. So these are some of the recent innovations of the department.
Well, those innovations really make it very attractive to go to the University of Toronto. You know, you talked about the sort of the focused or people focusing on the teaching aspects, the sort of one-year placement, which is perfect, and then this professional master's. And in fact, I do have an interview upcoming with Eugene.
Oh, great. Great. I'm delighted to hear it. So you'll get a lot more information from him. As well as, don't forget, I think, as a research professor, there's also the research that goes on in the department, our attraction for graduate students. We have in the order, and of course it depends on what time of the year But at this point, I think we're around 250 graduate students. And again, there's going to be a lot more coming in September. And, you know, I think that will always be one of the big attractions of DCS at U of T.
And you already discussed the fact that our graduates from your programs are everywhere in the world. And so now, more broadly, where do you see the challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, I'll restrict that to more academic areas. I certainly could not presume to answer that from the industrial and the business perspective. But from an academic perspective, one of the big concerns I have is our inability to attract a lot of really good undergrad students. We've had very strange background in this area, we as the in computer science internationally. For a while, you know, number of students seemed to be reasonable. Then there was all the dot-com explosion, and everybody was trying to get more and more students, and students were coming into computer science because of the opportunity of a good job without having any ability or interest in the area. And we had terrible times trying to educate these people, and it was an unhealthy situation. Then there was the dot-com bust, and the jobs evaporated. And similarly, our enrollments, undergraduate enrollments, declined. And again, the hour refers across the board, around the world. And now we're in a very unhealthy situation, in my opinion, where there's tremendous demand by industry and business. There's some really exciting jobs out there. Our students know quite a bit about computing from high schools and all the devices they have, and yet they are not translating a computer science education into getting into these jobs and doing stuff that's really interesting. So students that you would now think, because of their interaction with computers, would be really prime subjects to attract, we're just not getting that message through. And I see this, and again, this is across the board. I think one of the approaches I like, and we've, Suzanne Stevenson, one of the colleagues in our department, is in the dean's office and trying to develop some experiential education. So instead of a student having to learn about some data structure or whatever, some information structure, instead being in a situation, for example, looking at devices in a retirement residence for people who have either physical or mental handicaps. And in doing that, you're going to have to understand and develop an understanding of this type of data structure. Well, the kids will do a lot better on that. So I think there's a lot of attempt to try to get more relevant projects. Ron Becker has done a tremendous amount of work in this area, and a lot of research as well as involvement of graduate and undergraduate students. I think we also have an academic problem, an ongoing problem of attracting more women and also retaining more women in computer science. The a drop-off rate of women in computer science is really frightening. Again, when you compare that to the drop-off similar profile for men. Somehow we're really turning these young women off, and it goes right through the undergraduate years, into the graduate years, etc. Some universities have done a lot in this regard. We certainly have a lot of committees and attempts to help women in this, and you know, DCS women, for example, meet regularly. That's for the graduate students and the faculty. But obviously, a lot more has to be done. I think there's also an ongoing problem, and a lot of headway has been made in building bridges between academia and industry. Certainly, the professional masters is a problem that way. The Bell Labs that we set up, the centers of excellence that the Ontario government set up, the federal networks of excellence programs and things like that. A lot has been done, and a lot of very good work has been done. A lot more still to be done. But I think that'll always be a problem. We've got to do it better. And this technology transfer has to take place on 2 feet. And it's got to be a two-way communication. It's not just us saying, hey, here's our thing, here's our latest widget, anybody interested. There's got to be involvement of industrial people in what are interesting problems, etc. So, and another concern I have is funding of research in Canada, not only in computer science, but throughout research. And there's always a tendency of governments to micromanage research. In other words, to say, here are the strategic areas, it's absolutely essential that you work in this area, and in particular what this means is they take money away from the broad-based, curiosity-driven research and funnel it into the quota-driven or the here's restricted area. John Polanyi, Nobel laureate from U of T, has been very outspoken and eloquent on saying the importance of funding broadly based research and curiosity-driven research. NSERC, Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council, which is the granting council, federal granting council for computer science and other sciences and social sciences area, has done an absolutely fantastic job through its Discovery Grant program. So this is one where we're judged on our track record, the proposal we put in, and our development of highly qualified personnel. But less and less money is going into this, and we're getting much more targeted research, which is very counterproductive. Yet all international studies, or independent studies of NSERC, have shown for the amount of money Canada spent, and I think amongst the G10 or whatever, we're number 10 with regard to percentage of GDP that goes into research funding. It's just incredible the bang we've had for the buck. Primarily through the Discovery Grant Program, and I really worry as I see governments trying to get more, quote, strategic, unquote. I guess that's enough. A lot of issues raised there.
Well, you know, a key part of sort of providing solutions to these initiatives, or challenges, I should say, is to make them public and to have a public discourse and to do interviews like this to say these are the areas and the challenges that need to be addressed, and they have serious implications if they're not addressed. So that this is good that you're bringing this up.
Well, certainly John Polanyi has done a phenomenal role in trying to get that message to government. And the problem typically is at the political level, that, as we see throughout society, the politicians really want to, and understandably, I'm not blaming politicians, but there's got to be an education process that points out the importance of a proper blend of strategic and fundamental research programs.
So what would you say is the balance then between the provincial side of it politically and the federal side in terms of research funding?
This depends on the province. Some provinces, most notably Alberta and Quebec, have put a lot of money into their own research funding at the provincial level. There's really interesting things going on in the province of Alberta right now through their Alberta Ingenuity companies. And I've been involved in that as the chair of IRAC, and I'll try to say that when you're going across the border. Which the IRAC was a information technology research advisory committee to the old ICOR, and now its successor in the Alberta Ingenuity. And again, trying to direct research directions, but the or advise on new research directions, etc. But the province has put a lot of money into the development of research, and also interaction with industry, helping to spin off industry. I'm always worried with these types of things, as before, whether they've got the right balance between strategic and curiosity-driven. And a lot of work, a lot of dialogue is going on in this regard. But other provinces haven't put as much resources into it. I think they should. Some provinces in Ontario, for example, has done a very good job with their Centers of Excellence program. They've got various Premier's Award and things like that, but they don't have research funding to the same extent as Alberta and Quebec do. It's a very uneven situation across Canada from what I can see, and I don't know the other provinces that well.
Does the University of Toronto work with some of the major vendors out there, like IBM, Microsoft, and others?
Certainly. And again, this is not so much working with the vendors, but rather with the with them in their role as vendors, but rather in their role as industrial research. For example, the IBM Center of Excellence, of the IBM research establishment here in Toronto. And we have a lot of people who are affiliated with that. We have students taking internships there, working on practical stuff, and this is very well set up and works really well. There's also the, through Microsoft Research, a lot of our faculty go there, spend time there, top graduate students go there, so there's great chance of being involved with the industrial research labs. Setting up our own Bell Lab, Bell Emergis research lab, again, a lot of industrial collaboration done there. And again, there's people who have endowed chairs through Bell Emergis research lab. So yes, DCS does a lot of this type of thing. And of course, it depends on the faculty members. Some have very little involvement of that type of thing. Others have that taking up the majority of their research program.
And you yourself were instrumental in the formation of the Information Technology Research Center under the province of the Ontario Center of Excellence program, and you were the initial academic director of the Bell Emergis University of Toronto Labs.
Yeah, and I think that surprised a lot of people because of, first of all, the first one was while I was chair of the department. My own research does not have that the industrial aspect to it. So I was very much setting things up for other colleagues, but I've done very little direct industrial type of research. But I wanted to set it up in such a way that it was done properly and, again, didn't become too strategic. I wanted to make very certain that we had opportunities whereby people from industry and academics could talk, and it had to be two-way conversation. And one thing I learned very quickly, it was incorrect to use industry as a singular noun. There was just as much, if not more, different opinions and positions held by our industrial colleagues as our academic colleagues. And it was a good eye-opener on both sides. I think we really learned a lot. I was also very worried in the early days of ITRC at how little money was available for research in Canadian industry. And I really felt that we would know ITRC had succeeded when one of the big multinationals would develop a research center that would be able to take advantage of the research being done in the in southern Ontario. So I'm including certainly Waterloo and ourselves and York, et cetera, and Queens. IBM did precisely that. They had their center, their research center. So, and I look at some of the spin-off companies. We have a much, much better environment for knowledge-based industry in Ontario now than we did previously. And the Centers of Excellence, I think, was an excellent program. It always ran into the problem as to getting the right balance, as I say, between strategic and curiosity-driven research. CIAR and the work that Fraser Mustard did, also developing Precarn, and the work in artificial intelligence, that was a phenomenal tour de force by Fraser, and he was also instrumental in setting up the early centers, the Provincial Centers of Excellence program. Also, the provincial government has done a phenomenal job in, and I should have mentioned this when I was talking about the other provinces, Ontario has done a fantastic job with the Fields Institute of Mathematical Sciences Research, and taking mathematical sciences research in the broadest possible definition. So it's not just what the math department does or the theoreticians in a computer science department, but getting into medical imaging, into geography, and geological surveying, trying to find ore deposits, wherever there's a mathematical underpinning, then the Fields is interested. And this is part of a network of three or four of such institutes across Canada. And these institutes are doing a tremendous job. and the provinces, and in our case, the province of Ontario, deserves a tremendous amount of credit for its support, not only of the Centers of Excellence, but also of the Fields Institute.
You know, one of the areas that you brought up as a top challenge was this whole area of diversity and enrollments and in your graduate programs, and that is this sort of gender balance. And I know when I had my recent interview with Maria Clave, who also did graduate work at the University of Toronto, is now the president of Harvey Mudd College, which is a top 20 engineering college, undergraduate engineering college in the U.S., and she sits on the board of Microsoft and is quite a noted, distinguished professor and scientist in her own right. She indicated that they've been able to achieve that in their enrollments, and in fact, she's going to be speaking about it at the World CIO Forum, sort of a kind of a program that they've created to have this gender balance. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Yeah. In fact, Maria, when she was head, I know Maria very well, when she was head of computer science at UBC, she put a lot of emphasis and a lot of her own research. She was in same research area or similar research area that I'm in. And she shifted into the study of how do we attract, how do we educate women, how do we attract them into the sciences. She has done a fantastic job in that, and full credit to her. And I'm delighted that she's achieved that at Harvey Mudd, and would be speaking about it.
Is there any possibility of modeling some of what she's done at the University of Toronto? Or?
I don't know. And again, now that I'm retired, I'm not as actively involved in these types of issues and discussions. Certainly it's a problem we're very concerned about, and I certainly hope that we would be involved in hearing what she says and trying to see if there is some ideas we could use.
Now, we're at the end of our interview, and here I reverse the tables in that I'm saying you're conducting the interview. What questions would you have asked, that is, of yourself, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I think first question I would ask is, okay, looking back on your career, any regrets? And the answer would be absolutely, well, a few, of course. I remember one colleague visiting here asked me if I'd like to get involved with a certain project, and like an idiot, I said, no, I'm too busy, and I've kicked myself ever since. But I think the big thing is I wish people had a better understanding of what professors do. I have been so lucky to have this job. It was the ideal job. I could not have asked for a better job and a better place than what I've had here. Remember one time in my 40s, there was a lot of my friends and colleagues sitting around having their midlife crisis discussion about what do you wish you had done? And a lot of people saying, well, I wish I'd been a doctor, wish I'd been a lawyer, wish I'd done this, wish I'd done that. Came around to me, and I said, you've got to be kidding. I had the absolute dream job. Yes, I worked hard, but to be in a position where I and I alone decided what problems I would work on, the direction I would give to my students, what I thought was important to teach, this is such a privileged position in society, and to especially have had that at the University of Toronto and at DCS, how could I have ever been so lucky? So anyway, it was no regrets at all. I've been really, really happy.
Aren't people sort of surprised that you've gone to Professor Emeritus status and retired?
Some people have until they know the reason I've done it, or the reasons I've done it. And there are three reasons. First of all, I want more time for the family. We have 10 grandchildren, and I spend a lot of time, as much time as I can, with them and their parents. And secondly, I wanted more time for research. I've been really lucky lately. My research is going well. I've got a lot of stuff that I want to work on. I'm way, way behind in my writing. And this is my hobby. So I'm in at the office most of the time. I was lucky. I just had my NSERC grant renewed for another 5 years. Also, though, I really felt, and this is a very personal position, I really felt an obligation to release my position. Absolutely terrible out there for young academics. All my HQP, highly qualified personnel work, is trying to keep some really outstanding recent graduates in the system, even if it means I just supervise them for 3 or 4 months. And there's a network of us who do this. We identify the top, and we patch together these short-term postdocs to keep these people going. So I got my job without even applying for it. at my departmental oral when they were taking all this time for deciding whether or not I had passed. It turns out they were deciding whether or not to hire me after my postdoc in the Netherlands. I didn't even apply for this job, and I really felt an obligation to release the position with the full knowledge that it's going to be a while till it materializes. But I could not in good conscience keep this job long after my retirement, as well as I really wanted to get to my research and more time for family, and not tied down with administrative things, the bad end of teaching, you know, some of dealing with cheaters and setting exams and marking. I do miss, though, of course, not getting in front of a class and teaching. I really enjoyed that. But I do a lot of research lecturing, so things are going well.
And I guess us, as the audience, we're fortunate that because of the move, you did the interview.
Well, thank you very much, Ed.
Well, Derek, it's been such a joy to talk to you today, and I know your schedule is demanding. In fact, you just got back from an overseas trip, and I know you're tired. So, you know, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and you will continue to have global, international, national impact through your research and your mentorship of others. And, you know, I really do thank you for sharing your time and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Stephen Ibraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Derek Corneille, renowned and esteemed computer science professor emeritus at the University of Toronto.